Welcome to the UK's only weekly FM radio show on transportation. I'm Mark Ovenden. Today we're talking with an author, a professional transport journalist and a railway campaigner as well. Welcome to the Catchcast, Andy Bowes-Roden.
Hello, Mark.
Now, you've had a bit of a stellar career campaigning for and writing about trains and transport, Andy, and we're certainly going to get into all of that. But I seem to ask pretty much all my guests on this show a very similar first question, and that is, how did you originally get interested in things like railways?
Yeah, I'm not sure stellar so much as long. I hadn't realised quite how long I've been doing this until we started preparing for this. As with most people, it was father and grandfather who really sort of fired up the spark. And my dad would have everyone believe that because he was taking my mother to heritage railways around the West Midlands when she was pregnant with me, that coal smoke and steam got into my blood before I even arrived on this earth. Whether there is truth in that or not, who knows? But from a very, very early age, I was absolutely railway mad, and mad about anything that moves, really. So not just railways, planes, boats. If it's got an engine, the chances are I'll have an interest in it.
I think that always plays a role, doesn't it? It's something that happened to you in your childhood. I remember my dad dragging me along disused railways because it was just after the beaching cuts had kicked in the sort of mid to late 60s, and there were a lot of abandoned railways.
I missed all of the beaching cuts, but there were old railways that we used to take dogs for walks on. And I think with anything like this, there's a sort of romance to it that appeals. And particularly as a kid, it's the sense that you're dealing with really big, noisy, loud stuff. And when we start looking into the history of things, it becomes more and more fascinating. And the longer you look into the history, and this is many, many years now, it just remains absolutely fascinating. The story of the railways is so often the story of our country and the story of our society over the last 200 years.
Yeah, we are just steeped in the history. And did you follow any of those childhood interests in your studies or in your early work, Andy?
Well, I am the least practical person on the planet. Whenever I get the power tools out, my wife drops a local A&E line just to alert them in case. So I didn't really imagine that I would have a career on the railway. But as soon as I learned to drive, I lived in Shropshire at the time, and I started to volunteer on the Severn Valley Railway as an engine cleaner at Bewdley, which was incredibly hard work, but immensely rewarding. And that kind of brought railways to life in a way that I don't think you're ever going to get by just reading books or watching the things. I think when you get your hands on the kit, when you start to understand how it all works at a practical level, it sort of amplifies your interest. And I mean, that was just the most wonderful time. I was young and I was fit then. I'm not sure I'd fancy doing that now. But it gives you an appreciation of just how hard people in every element of the railway had to work in steam days. You know, these guys, especially on the footplate, had to be incredibly fit.
Yeah.
Fitter, I suspect, than most of us who fly desks most of the time have ever been or will be.
They didn't need to go working out to keep themselves fit. And so what about your first job then? I believe that was at Rail Magazine in around about 2000. What kind of issues were you covering when you started off?
I started the week before the Hatfield derailment in 2000, straight out of university, first time living away from home. And it would be fair to say to the guys I worked with that it took quite a while for me to really get up to speed with things. It was a fascinating time in the industry, not for the accidents that we had. We had a stream of them at the time, Hatfield, Great Heck, Potter's Bar. But you were sort of seeing the privatised railway get towards its pomp, if you like. There were new train fleets coming in left, right and centre. There were new initiatives. It was all really, really exciting. And so you end up covering every element of the industry, from the trains to the infrastructure and the policy. And it seemed slightly absurd at the time, as a young man in his early 20s, that you would go out and you would interview these incredibly senior people in this industry that you'd idolised all your life and be taken seriously. It was absolutely wonderful.
Wow, lucky man. And I think it was during this time when you were at Rail that you had a bit of a royal scoop, didn't you?
Yeah. And the way this came about was rather wonderful, because I'd come back from a really severe spell of depression. It wasn't really certain how I would cope, but I'd done some quite interesting features around depot visits and the like, and the opportunity for Rail Magazine to actually do a feature in depth on the Royal Train and go around it came up. Now, to his credit, the editor at the time, Nigel Harris, and features editor Pip Dunn, decided it would be quite good if I could have a go at it, because one of the things I was doing quite well at the time was to take our readers with me, almost perch them on my shoulder and chat about it and try and convey what it was like to be there. And so very luckily, I went to Wolverton with our features editor, Pip Dunn, to tour the Royal Train. We interviewed some of the team. It was just the most remarkable place. You walk in there and you get this smell of oil and wax polish and varnish. And it's like the most amazing scented candle you can possibly imagine.
Wow.
And the sense of pride at Wolverton was like nothing I'd come across before and very seldom since. It was one of those features that almost writes itself. When you start writing, the words just seem to flow onto the screen without you noticing you're writing them. And it's still 24 years on. I think it's probably one of the best things I've ever done. And it's immensely sad to me that the Royal Train is going to be axed at a point where I think you can make a strong case for some sort of replacement train for the royal family, for heads of state, for the prime minister and the like, to travel securely around the country into Europe and sustainably. We have the ability in this country to build our own trains. That's not something every country has. We could almost, I think, with the forthcoming high-speed 2 trains, add some vehicles to that production line, fettle them out as, if you like, a train for Britain, and really use it as a flagship for what the railway can do at its very best. And I think the railway and I think government is missing a huge trick here.
This is fascinating stuff. And now we know a bit of your background, Andy. Thank you very much for that. But it's not just trains you love, is it, I believe? I think you went to work for a magazine that also covers buses and coaches in 2004.
Yeah, that's right. One of those periodic reorganisations that EMAP had at the time, Coach and Bus Week, this weekly bus and coach industry magazine, became part of the transport team. And I spent quite a lot of time sort of around the office chatting with them and making them welcome. And they seemed like they were having such a good time. And they were so lovely, all of them, some real characters on that team, that when an opportunity came up to work with them as a staff writer, I thought it would be quite interesting to try something completely different, to kind of stretch those writing skills, if you like. So I was released from Rail Magazine. I joined Coach and Bus Week. And I was only there for a year, but it was absolutely wonderful. The bus industry, the coach industry, the people in it are just wonderful. They are so friendly, they are so open, they are so positive. I did some amazing trips out as well, one to Northern Ireland on a tourism tour around there. And it was brilliant because that actually gives you that different perspective on transport that says it isn't just about railways, it isn't just about buses. People just want to move from A to B.
Yeah.
And there'll be a million ways they can do it. So as a career break, as a sort of palate cleanser from the railway, it was wonderful.
Yeah, I could completely agree with you. It's all about how people get. The passenger doesn't care, do they, what vehicle they're on,
no,
as long as they get from A to B. But being down in the southwest of England inspired you to be involved in a bit of a campaign about its overnight services, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Back in 2005, I was offered something that doesn't happen very often, which is a move to Cornwall and a pay rise and a promotion. So I moved down to join International Railway Journal, which is the global rail industry's Bible, if you like. And just after I moved down, the Strategic Rail Authority released a consultation document about the future of rail in the southwest. And in there somewhere buried was a line that said, we think the Night Riviera sleeper service, which runs from London to Penzance, is uneconomic and we want franchise bidders to present costed options for its withdrawal. And the editor at the time, a lovely guy called David Brigginshaw, was reading through this and he jumped up from his seat, swore very loudly at this, which never, ever happened. He's the most gentle man you can imagine. But he said words to the effect of, the so-and-sos want to close our sleeper. And I don't think it's easy to appreciate, when you're up country as I was before I moved down to Cornwall, just how important this train is, because we are a long way down the line. It takes 5 hours or more to get to London. We are very, very remote. And it is very, very difficult to get to London for flights or onward connections by rail before 9 o'clock unless you stay in a hotel, which adds not just cost, but also half a day's travelling the day before. So the Sleeper is a real lifeline service. It's the one train that really allows Cornwall to compete and punch its weight economically and politically. And so almost by accident, really, we found ourselves running this campaign, and the IRJ guys were very good. They gave me the time and space to do it, really making the case that says this service is absolutely vital. The claims that are being made about the economics are fabulously unclear, and we need to keep it. And so what happened was that rather magically, people from all sorts of walks of life started to get engaged. They started to write letters to MPs. They started to travel on the train. They started to do their own lobbying. And we ended up with what at the time was, I think, the biggest single issue rail campaign since the one which saved the Fort William Sleeper a decade or so earlier. And I think the biggest until the ticket office campaign a few years ago. We managed to get the great and the good in Cornwall involved and very, very cross. And it showed two things, really. One, that if everyone pulls together, Cornwall can do magnificent things. And I've been here a long time now, and I firmly believe that. The second thing is that if you can make a rational case for something, in this case, retaining our Sleeper train, you stand a chance of success. And I think for anyone listening who's sort of wondering about how to do a campaign, it is start with something rational. Don't go with wishful thinking. Wouldn't it be nice if... If you make a credible case, if you argue it well, you stand a chance.
Fantastic. And thank goodness that you did, and that service has survived. Well done to you all.
Yeah, 7,000 people saved the Sleeper. And to be part of that is something I will always look back on with immense pride for what we all managed to achieve.
Excellent. There you go. A lesson for us all there. Now, I understand that also during this time, you wrote a rather superb book around the mid-noughties. Tell us about that too, please, Andy.
Yeah, a classic case. The Sleeper was involved in this, actually. Mm-hmm. I was chatting with the stewards outside the Sleeper, and a couple of years before, I'd edited a book for a company called Oran Press on Mallard, the world's fastest steam locomotive. Publisher at the time said, was very nice, and he said, "You've got a lovely style, we ought to do a book sometime." And I just thought, okay, that's a lovely thing to say. Didn't think any more of it. So I was waiting by the Sleeper after a trip abroad, and this chap, lovely guy called Graham Costa, turns up, and we went into the bar car, as everyone should on the Sleeper, and we had a couple of drinks, and we started chatting, and said, "What's the most famous locomotive in the world?" "It's Flying Scotsman." And he said, "Okay, why?" So I sort of ran him through its achievements, non-stop run, American trip, and so on. And he said, "Yeah, but why is it so famous?" And I didn't really have an answer to that, because you can argue a rational case that says there are faster locomotives, older locomotives, more technically significant locomotives, and so on. And so over a few pints, we sketched out the idea of this book about Flying Scotsman doing something completely different from everything else, which is to approach it from a sceptical point of view and just test whether this machine really deserves its fame. And so what came out of this was a book that tells the story of Flying Scotsman and the people around it, not written as a sort of straightforward railway history, but almost as a non-fiction novel. And it's a fascinating story. I started as a skeptic, but the more I dug into it, the more I talked to people, the more I learned about the context around Flying Scotsman, the more I'm absolutely convinced that for all the fact that you can argue a better case for something else, actually we are incredibly lucky as a nation and as a railway to have this talisman that is so recognised and so adored. And Flying Scotsman must be the best-selling tool the railway could possibly have. So first book, I did a few more, as we may come onto them a bit later. But I'd always said I'd like to write a book at some point in my 40s. That would be a nice sort of thing to do as I get through my career. So be able to do that in my 20s and to have a book reviewed in the Times was really quite something. Just pure luck that it happened, really.
Oh, well done to you. Yeah, it is an amazing feeling when you bring out your first book. Now, I want to move on a little bit. A lot of rail professionals have got a bit of a fascination for building their own model railways too, don't they, Andy?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
And as a journalist, you took that a step further by working for a magazine for one of the leading model train producers, didn't you?
This came about, an old friend of mine from EMAP days, a guy called Mike Wild, was approached to start what was initially a bi-monthly magazine for Ian Allen back when it published railway titles, called Hornby Magazine. And Mike called me. He'd helped out quite a lot with Flying Scotsman. And he asked if I could look at sub-editing the copy for it. And so I started sub-editing it, and I'm very, very happy to say that I've sub-edited every single issue of that magazine since. It's one of the things I am most proud of being involved in. It's a wonderful, wonderful magazine, and you know, to be able to say that you've done something for 20 years from the very first issue is very, very special.
Wow, and we love our model railways. We've spoken to a lot of them on here, and they do make the most incredible scenery out of basically things in the garage or wonderful stuff they bought from Hornby. Andy, we've heard about your books, your sleeper campaign, your Royal Train scoop, and you went fully freelance, I believe, in 2009. Talk with us about some of the amazing clients and titles you worked with during that time, please, Andy.
Yeah, I went freelance when my daughter was born to be a stay-at-home dad, really. It was absolutely the best decision I've ever made in my life. And so I went freelance. I was still working for Hornby magazine, still sub-editing that. And I managed to win a few other clients. So I sub-edited Railways Illustrated for a while. I did work for UK Trade and Investment. I did a brochure for them. I did some PR work. And I did some more books as well. And, I mean, my goodness, everyone, I think, employed in work moans about their employers sometimes, but when you run your own business, there is no one to moan about. It is entirely on you. It's a huge, huge learning experience. Mm. And one of the things that came through in that freelance time was the opportunity to edit Steam World, which is a historical railway magazine. And that was just the most fun because there's no news really to worry about because that all happened 60-odd years ago. And so what you're doing is you're talking to people who remembered the Steam Age, who photographed the Steam Age, who've written about the Steam Age, and you're putting that into print. It was absolutely fabulous fun. Mm.
And an issue that I know just crops up a lot online is the need for coal to be used by the engines. I mean, talk with us about what the future might be for our wonderful heritage steam railways in a kind of net zero age. Is there much discussion about that?
There is discussion about that, and I think, to be honest, the total emissions from every heritage railway in the country burning coal are so tiny compared with anything else. Really, it just shouldn't be a consideration. There's always going to be a need for people to burn something somewhere. If you've got a log burner in your house, you're burning stuff. So I really hope that legislation doesn't start strangling our heritage railways because, okay, I can get on board with the idea of oil firing to reduce fire risk in hot summers, but that smell of coal smoke is so intrinsic to understanding what a steam locomotive is, why it is so alive, that to lose that, I think, would be an absolute travesty. Yeah. The big question, I think, ultimately will be, can they physically get the coal? I think that may be the biggest challenge of all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we definitely want to keep our heritage railways going, especially for the younger people coming up. I think you spent, was it about 6 years with Steam? And then after that, around about 2021, you moved to the very prestigious Modern Railways magazine. How did that come about? And talk with us about the role of a deputy editor in a modern magazine, please, Andy.
Well, I mean, Modern Railways has always been the sort of benchmark for anything reporting around the rail industry. It has always been the standard everything else seeks to match. So an opportunity came to join Modern Railways. I've edited magazines. I know exactly what that entails. And the best role of all, actually, is probably deputy editor, because you don't have as much of the administration stuff that is really important for an editor to do, but you still have a key input in the magazine. And I mean, Modern Railways is just incredible to be able to work with people like Roger Ford, who won't mind me saying, I'm sure that he's getting on a bit, but he's still the sharpest knife in the block you can imagine. And the chance to learn from people like that is just unbelievable. It's an absolute joy every day. And I think sometimes you kind of have to pinch yourself and think, I'm actually being paid to do something that is so much fun with such brilliant people, and occasionally to be able to make a difference as well.
Oh, wow. Lucky man, lucky man. And there are a lot of really big live issues right now on the railways, aren't there? Northern Powerhouse, HS2, renationalisation, so many things going on. Maybe could you talk us through some of the biggest discussions going on that you've been writing about recently?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the big one is Great British Railways, because it will change every facet of the railway. And depending on who you talk to, nationalisation is either the best thing ever or it is the worst thing ever and it'll be a disaster. And the reality is actually that who owns a railway doesn't make a blind bit of difference. You can see that when you look around the world. vertically integrating the railway does, because for the first time in 30 years and more now, you'll have a railway that is entirely in control of its own destiny. It controls its tracks, it controls its trains, it can make those whole system decisions. And providing the politicians give it the funding it needs, and providing the politicians get out of the way and let the railway do it, I have no doubt we'll see a better railway. If the politicians don't give it the funding and don't get out of the way, well, we'll see perhaps the railway at its worst, and its worst in the old BR days. But I don't think it will come to that. I think Great British Railways will work.
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, obviously, the privatisation era has led to a lot of interesting developments and a big growth in passengers. It's just that certainly for the passengers, it does feel a bit daunting when you see this big array of different operations out there and everyone's got different systems. So let's hope GBR can solve some of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the privatised railway has had twice the level of subsidy British Rail ever did. Mm. And there's a counterfactual there that says, how would BR have done with that? I think GBR will do well, providing it doesn't get its costs shaved right down to the bone.
Now, aside from your continuing work on the Hornby magazine and also your full-time job at Modern Railways, you also keep your hand in with campaigning for a better transport system. What is the Tavistock to Oakhampton reopening scheme all about, and how come you're pressing for it?
Well, I guess the key lesson from Save Our Sleeper was, don't assume that if there's an issue that might need solving that someone else will do it. So we all remember the pictures back in 2014 of the railway at Dawlish with the track hanging in the air from storm damage. So for a few years, I was sort of reporting on the issues and looking at them in depth. And just before the pandemic, around sort of 2019, 2020, I was able to start assembling a team of real experts to take a closer look at this and ask questions that hadn't quite been asked by any of the other studies. So we have people like Jim Steer, founder of Steer Consultancy, a huge multinational consultancy, Jim Collins, who used to be MD of Thameslink. We have former project directors at likes of Mott MacDonald, academics, and me, basically jumping around and making a lot of noise about it. And so the question we asked of this is the railway that used to run from Plymouth to Exeter via Tavistock and Oakhampton around the top edge of Dartmoor, was, is there a way we can operate this railway efficiently that makes sense economically and operationally, and that doesn't depend on weather-related diversions from the main line to make its case? And the work we've done so far, all pro bono, no one's made a penny out of this, but we have saved taxpayers tens of thousands of pounds in the process. The conclusion we've reached so far is that if we extend the London Waterloo to Exeter services around the top via Oakhampton and Tavistock, you can run an hourly service with competitive journey times, doesn't require many more trains, many more train crew, but it has really good revenue potential. And then because it is much more easily graded than the coastal route, some real potential for rail freight as well. So the slight problem we have, as every other project has, is that there is no money from government anywhere to possibly fund this. But we think we've made a good case. It has got buy-in from the region's MPs. And I think over time, we will succeed. I think we will get that railway reopened.
That would be amazing, because clearly poor old Dawlish is still going to get hit by big waves and you can't avoid that.
Yeah.
So very briefly to end off with, you mentioned Great British Railways. I mean, what's your hopes for the future? Are we going to have reduced fares and more investment? Do you think things can get better, Andy?
I think things will get better. I don't think we're going to see fares going down more. But if we could have a railway that achieves the very best that BR did and the very best that the privatised railway did in terms of its innovation, its entrepreneurship, its efficiency, a combination of the best of both, that really takes competition to roads and air and Zoom and Teams and the like, that really seeks to serve the country rather than serve shareholders' interests alone, it could be really powerful. That's my hope, but it's going to take time and there's going to be a real need for patience before we start seeing some radically big improvements here, I think.
But a new golden age may well be on the horizon. It sounds like you and me could go on nattering about our favourite subject for some time, but we have to put it into a station now. Thank you so much for explaining your fantastic railway life to us.
No problem at all. Thanks ever so much, Mark.
You can find Andy's wonderful books online, plus subscribe to the magazine at modernrailways.com and also Hornby magazine too. Plus, I think you may be able to find them in local libraries as well, so go and visit your local library and attend those too. Join us next time for more chatting art, transport, communications history on Vectis Radio.